We have a scripture this morning in John chapter 8, verses 31 through 36. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?" Jesus replied, "I tell you the truth. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed."
Do you remember what Lance just read? I hope so, because that's the sermon for the day. We'll get back to it at the end of the presentation, because most of what I have for you is a report and analysis of what's going on in the not-so-free religious liberty world. But we will get back to that, and there will be sermonizing at the very end. But for the moment, I would like to talk to you about a couple of things that have to do with a magazine. You know the Liberty Magazine. You know that year after year I get up here and I push this. There's a reason, and we'll talk about that about the end of the presentation as well. Freedom and liberty are something that we take for granted, aren't they? When I looked up the word free or freedom in our hymnal, I came up with song number 110 that we used for an opening song. If you can find another one in there that has that word in the title, let me know, because I didn't. That is free mercy of God streaming. Well, that freedom is something every one of us does enjoy. And we had to sing about that to start this. We'll have a very different ending on something that capitalizes on our God's power to do things when things aren't perfect. Let's talk about when things stopped being perfect. Freedom. What was the cost to God for our freedom? When do you think he recognized that cost? You know, it predates the cross. It predates Eden. Before he created us, before he created the earth, before he created Lucifer, he knew what was going to happen. And yet, he did it. Why? Have you ever asked yourself that question before? Because that is very significant about God. I think he did it because he knew the world, the universe, needed to understand the results and the consequences of sin. And our experience with it, I guess we could treat it as an inoculation against sin for eternity. That's how you handle disease. You inoculate against it. You vaccinate against it. Now, I believe I have read recently that this state of Oregon, and I'm sure there are other states, has been facing a little bit of a controversy with some parents that do not wish to have their children vaccinated. I wonder what God would tell them about the long-term effects of that choice. I think he says there is a reason for doing this. In the long run, it's well worth the pain. In this world today, we do have a lot of pain. In this world, we have a lot of conditions that are not desirable, not pleasant. For some people, are fatal. You know that in the 10 years from the 2005 to 2015, there is a report by the Gordon Conwell Center for the Study of Global Christianity that says 900,000 Christians were martyred. That's 90,000 a year. How many people live in this valley? That's more than live in this valley every year, Christians dying. As martyrs. Not just dying, as martyrs. That tells you something about the world we live in? I don't think you need to do much analysis on something like that. In this world, we have a few influences that we don't really think are good. I think you all would feel like, okay, the ISIS is not my choice of the best neighbor to have. They are not just anti-Christian, which they are, severely. They are even anti-Muslim. Among their own people. You have to agree with me or else. That is the antipathy of religious freedom. Total opposite. What are you going to do in a world like that? What would you do in a world like Pakistan? I picked that country. I could pick any of a dozen countries and point out examples of intolerance and of problems for Christians. You ever hear of the blasphemy laws? Laws that on the surface are supposed to be respectful of a particular belief. And we would want others to be respectful of ours, right? I think that's good Christian attitude toward things. They seem to take it a little further than that. The problem, I think, is that, number one, blasphemy is not a law that pertains to doing something against a fellow citizen. This is a law that says you cannot say anything bad about my God. Well, that's taking on the prerogative and usurping the right of God himself to judge and punish. Wrong. Wrong. Unfortunately, these blasphemy laws are used oftentimes for personal revenge and personal gain, and against mostly Christians. These kinds of things we would say are wrong, whether they had to do with blasphemy or any other thing. Taking advantage of somebody is wrong. That's not the way we do business in our world, right? Well, wait a minute, our world includes that. That's not a nice thing. In many of these cases, the victims are being accused falsely. This isn't something where it's a true statement that, yeah, these guys did something that offended my God or offended me because of my God. These are conditions where somebody is using this as a pretext to take advantage of somebody else's weakness, and in their mind, being a Christian is a weakness. Being a Christian is something we want to eradicate. The story is told about one young man. I think he was 24 years old when this story started. His name is Sajjad Masih Gill. He was jailed December 28, 2011. I believe he was 24 years old at that point. So he would be 29 or 30 years old by now. He's still in jail in Pakistan. His situation is very, very simple. His girlfriend, who he and she both very, very nicely together wanted to be together, and the parents of the girl said, "No, you're going to marry such and such." And in that world, that's what happens. The girl had to marry this other person. Took her to the United Kingdom, where that man lived. And the unfortunate behavior situation was that she kept in contact with boyfriend. Husband got jealous. Purchased a SIM card for a cell phone in her name. Used it to send text messages that were profane against the Muslims. Not wise. And as soon as the person that received these text messages and the identification apparently in the texting made it possible to say, okay, this was from so-and-so going to or about this young man that ended up getting jailed. No evidence on this young man's phone that those messages were ever sent. It was turned over to the police. They examined it. Totally free. Totally. Why then was he convicted? No evidence. Fear on the part of the judges, on the part of the police. Fear from fundamentalists, from extremists, from those that are willing to go outside the law that we understand to be a right kind of law to take their kind of vengeance against judges, against police. This young man's family thought after these number of years that there was going to be a resolution to this, because in Pakistani law, there is a situation where if you have not had a review of a conviction within 2 years and there is no evidence, you are automatically released. Well, that was an interesting thing for me to learn. I had not been aware of anything like that. And so they petitioned the court for this hearing. And the hearing got postponed. 8 times because of the fear on the part of the judges. I don't want to be the one that releases this guy. December 9 last year, we're talking a couple of months ago, the final hearing on this was scheduled. The family makes the trip to Lahore for this trial. They start the hearing, and the judge begins to recognize what is really at stake here, and he interrupts it. Stop. I'm not going to hear this case. This will be heard by another court. That's how justice is being handled in Pakistan. This gentleman has been in prison now for over 5 years. I don't think I'd want to be in his place. That's a young man. December 28 of last year, a 70-year-old man was accused of putting a letter on the door of a local mosque in Pakistan. This is one of those situations where nobody in their right mind would put anything like this out there because they know what the consequences are going to be. There is absolutely no evidence that he wrote it. His handwriting is not the same as that which was on the letter. He's in jail too. Why? Fear. Fear of reprisals. In both of those cases, there was personal gain involved. One, jealousy over the wife, the girlfriend of this boy. On this last one, folks wanted the property this man owned. And they had offered him a ridiculously low price, and they'd threatened him and said, "You get out of here or I'm going to take it away from you." The man's in jail. A fabricated evidence charge. This is not liberty. This is not freedom. This is people using religious laws for their own personal benefit. Pakistan is full of all sorts of kinds of problems. There are 11 television stations, broadcast facilities, that are prohibited on the cable networks in Pakistan. Now, that's pure religious discrimination. In 2014, this country tried to make some efforts in the direction of taking care of their minorities. The Supreme Court directed the establishment of the National Council for the Rights of Minorities. How did that work out? Almost nothing. Implementation, practically zero. One of the Christian church leaders in that country wrote these words. May have said them, I'm not sure. Such rulings, now they're talking about this ruling to establish this council to help the minorities. Such rulings are not very common in our country. It was exceptional to get that. It was not easy to combine the philosophy of human rights, Islamic justice, and minority rights. Finally, we got justice, but non-compliance frustrated us. So even when the law says you'll do this, it doesn't necessarily happen. Would that happen here in the United States? I don't know. I'm not sure. It could, I guess. There's another example in Pakistan of something that has a very interesting parallel in another part of the world. There's a group called the Ahmadiyya. They are a sect of the Muslims that believe in a different prophet. And as such, they are out of the mainstream. But they still have power, and they still have the ability to be a problem to Christians. Believe it or not, they are doing so by occupying the territory, the property of a Christian community's cemetery. Yeah, they've taken over part of the area of a cemetery to occupy and to live on. One of the pictures I have here of the thing shows grave sites opened up. They're digging them up, taking the stuff away, and building there. Occupying somebody else's territory sound anything like maybe the West Bank? We see these kinds of problems all over the world, don't we? Well, that's not good. Okay, would we ever have a problem like this in the United States? Well, maybe not that kind of problem. 1954, there was a very powerful senator from Texas by the name of Lyndon Johnson that was fighting for his position in the Senate. And there were a couple of churches who were opposing him. And he took advantage of a finance reform bill going through Congress to shut them up. That doesn't sound nice, does it? Lyndon Johnson, soon to be Vice President Johnson and later President Johnson, succeeded in being reelected because he was able to say, "You guys cannot talk about political stuff and maintain your IRS tax exemption." That doesn't sound fair to the churches, does it? Taking away their freedom of speech. But, believe it or not, Romans 8:28 came into play. Remember what that says? God will make everything work out even when it doesn't start out looking good. Because what really developed out of that was that the churches became immune to political influence. Now, that is not the obvious answer that Lyndon Johnson had in mind. But by saying you cannot talk about politics, and if you do, you lose your tax exemption, what he's really doing is taking the churches out of politics. And that was good, because churches in politics is not good. And that's exactly what President Trump wants to change. Now, we had a discussion Wednesday night in prayer meeting about something called the Johnson Amendment. It's the one I just mentioned in 1954. Trump wants to have the churches involved in this. He wants to have the finances of the churches available to the politicians. There's a lot of money in the churches. He wants that money available to politics. This evening during the business meeting, there will be a motion made that we approve a formal policy that will keep us behaving the same way we have for the last many decades in our church, that eliminates us from being, as a church, a participant in politics. Nothing whatever to do with each individual person, but as a church entity, not to participate in politics. That will eliminate some of the pressure on us if this IRS regulation, which, the, believe it or not, the president does have the legal right to change. He can, even though it was passed by Congress. This is an executive department action, and it is something he has the authority over. If he changes it, it would not mean any change for us if we take care of it with our own policies. The alternative, if you don't take care of this, is very, very simple. Division of opinion, churches splitting over politics. I don't know whether you've ever lived in a church that had folks that believed a little differently than you did on political questions. I have. And I don't imagine that even here we all see eye to eye perfectly in unison on politics. Why should we? Division within churches is not the worst of it, though. Division within the country is what we had in 1963. We're going back a ways, aren't we, yet? 1963. Does anybody remember the name of Madeline Murray O'Hare? And the subject was prayer in schools. This country was divided over that, a very significant religious question. We do have problems with those kinds of things, don't we? And the allegation was made at that time, oh, this is a Christian nation. We should be able to have our prayers in our schools. Got news for you, folks. Our Constitution and our Bill of Rights says we are a nation composed of a populace that includes Christians and others. And we will respect all of them, whether they believe in religion or not, whether they believe in your religion or not, we will respect everybody's right to believe as they wish. And here in Washington, we have a business over in Richland that has chosen to believe as a business differently from what others do. Everybody hear of Arlene's Flowers? And the name of the gal that owns it, she and her husband, Baronelle Stutzman. Just Thursday of this week, 8 o'clock Thursday morning of this week, the formal opinion of the Washington State Supreme Court was filed, affirming the decision of a lower court that Arlene's Flowers and Bernadelle Stutzman, Baronell, had broken the law, had violated the law, forgive me. You don't break a law, you violate it. The only way you can break a law is to repeal it. She had violated a law. The problem isn't really that she decided to break the law. The problem is that the citizens of the state of Washington sent a bunch of representatives to Olympia that passed Senate Bill 6239. And when that bill was passed, it changed the law. Anybody that disagrees with what that law says needs to take it back to the legislature. Just breaking the law or violating it is not the solution. I read every page of that 65-page opinion. They really went through every single claim her lawyers made to try to get her out from under this. They can't. The law is the law. The question is, would you agree with her action in saying, oh, I'm not going to serve that particular customer in that particular setting? Remember, these were customers of hers that had been dealing with her for years. She knew they were gay. That wasn't a problem. She drew the line when it came to, I'm not going to approve of this same-sex marriage ceremony by contributing my products to it, or by selling them. The difficulty is that's a violation of the law. Now, she claims that she did it because of her Christian faith. Okay. Now, there is a time and a place, maybe, for civil disobedience. And if this were a condition where she was violating her conscience and she refused to violate her conscience and yet knowingly and intentionally broke the law, that's one set of circumstances. But she is claiming before the courts, I'm not violating anything. That's inconsistent, illogical, and it doesn't fly. The Washington Supreme Court essentially sent this to the United States Federal Supreme Court. If the attorneys from the organization in Arizona that are her defendants, that are her defenders, choose to take it on to the U.S. Supreme Court, that's where this will end up. In my considered opinion, after having read all of that, there won't be any change in the verdict. The law is the law. If you want to do something about it, you change the law. So what makes one kind of discrimination different from another? Discriminating against same-sex marriage? What about those that discriminated against black integration? Talking about the 60s again. What about those that knowingly violated the laws of the South because they felt there was a principle involved that was worth putting themselves in jeopardy? That's a discrimination that it was good to protest. From a purely humanistic evolutionary point of view, is there a logical difference between objecting to segregation or integration versus same-sex marriage? Without the principles and standards that God's law provides, there is nothing but human opinion to guide our value decisions. We have that law. We can count on that law. We depend on God's law. That is what we can use as our standard. And I guess we have to ask the question, at what cost to our civilization, to our culture, to our lifestyle, have we allowed secularism to overwhelm our sense of values? That's what's happened, folks. We have. With this history behind us, what is ahead of us? What can you and I do to minimize the impact that anti-religion forces can make in our future? That's a question that you really need to ask. You should be asking, because it's going to happen. The attempts will continue to be made to change your world. My world. What's behind it? Satan. Satan is desperately trying to derail everything that's good. He knows his time is short. He is using all of his influence, his temptations, to chain us to him. He wants to eliminate us as soldiers of God. He doesn't want us in those ranks. He does not want us to enjoy the liberty and the freedom that Jesus promised us. That's what he's all about. Psalm 119, verse 45 says, I will walk at liberty, for I seek your precepts. I will speak of your testimonies also before kings and will not be ashamed. And I will delight myself in your commandments, which I love. David and another author that we'll visit in a moment used a method of expression here that sort of got the cart before the horse. They talk about the effect first, and then they talk about the cause afterwards. Listen to these words again. I will walk at liberty because I seek your precepts. wait a minute. Let's get this in order. Because I am one with God, I walk in his liberty. That's what really happens. The relationship exists, and then we have the freedom he promises. One of the more familiar verses to you, Jeremiah 29, verse 13. We'll read it as it's written in the book, and then look at it again. You will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. Oh, he's got it backwards again. Jeremiah did the same thing David did. Effect first, then cause. Well, let's look at that. When you search for me with all your heart, what's going to happen? You'll find me. When Jesus talked about this, he got it in the other order. I love the way he talks about it in John 8. This is what Lance read earlier. And the words there that were so important are from verses 31 and 32. Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, first, the cause, if you abide in my word, then you're my disciples. Then you'll know the truth. And what was the last part of that? The truth shall make you free. Who is the truth? Jesus. The truth, Jesus, makes us free. So what do we do for the future? We avoid things like the disaster of Senate Bill 6239 by talking with our legislators, with letting them know what's important to us, with contributing to the Liberty campaign so that they have funds to make sure that this Liberty magazine gets into the hands of all of the opinion formers in our government and elsewhere. This is how you help. But much, much more important than that is to follow the advice of David and Jeremiah. Seek him with all your heart. That's the story in a nutshell. Now, you then get the chance to live out the words in our closing song. We are living, we are dwelling in a what kind of time and a what kind of place? It's not necessarily good. But that's what we're going to be living in, and let's sing about that.